You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great weekend, and I've got a great episode for you. So up first, last week I interviewed Ingrid Seward, editor of Majesty magazine, about Prince Harry's recent interviews with Oprah, one as part of her special with Harry and Meghan, and then Apple TV's The Me You Can't See about mental health. So for this episode, I wanted to hear from Harry and Meghan's side. So I interviewed Omid Scobie. He's a London-based writer, royal editor for Harper's Bazaar, an ABC News contributor, Good Morning America regular, and the host of ABC's popular royal podcast, The Air Pod. He's become an authoritative voice on the lives and philanthropic endeavors of the royal family's younger members, and he maintains strong access to the Sussexes' working world. He is the co-author of Finding Freedom, Harry and Meghan, and the Making of a Modern Royal Family. And then I asked my friend Steve Stoff, who you know is hilarious, to review Pink's documentary, Pink, All I Know So Far. This is an Amazon Prime documentary. It follows Pink as she embarks on a record-breaking 2019 Beautiful Trauma World Tour while trying to balance being a mom, a wife, a boss, and a performer. So it's great because it mixes footage from the road. There's behind-the-scenes interviews and personal material. It's directed by Michael Gracie, who did The Greatest Showman. He gives this great glimpse behind the curtain of the circus that she calls life. It's shot over 3 weeks in Europe, and she's got her husband with her. She's been married for 15 years, 17 at this point, to freestyle motocross champion Kerry Hart. And during the time of filming, her daughter Willow was 8 and her son Jameson was 2. So from the start of it, you really see the juxtaposition of her life. She's this fearless performing badass swinging on a chandelier above a huge crowd, but then she's also this busy mother ushering her family from one city to the next, hoping that she gives each child enough attention and the opportunities a normal child would experience on a summer break. Because at one point her daughter's like, I want to go back and just be like at summer camp with my friends. So I just think there's so much to relate to as moms. She discusses the challenges of life on the road and the new anxieties brought on by motherhood. So not only does she want her tour to be perfect for her fans, so she's this incredible boss, but she also wants it to be worthwhile for her kids, who she's taking along with her on a journey, making sure that they've got these great memories together as a family. So there's tons of pressure. The pressure of ensuring that the audience gets the most incredible concert experience of their lifetime, but also trying to ensure that her children feel connected to her. So it's really a love letter to the fans who've watched her grow up and to her children, who at some point might not remember all the details about traveling with their mother on, you know, a summer world tour. But it's also, I feel like, a love letter to kids who struggle to feel valued, because she talks about her own struggles growing up in a divorced family and you know, just being a little bit different than everybody else. And lastly, a love letter to mothers, particularly working mothers who want to create and to also be present for their children as they grow. So I really loved it. And so Steve helped me review it. So here we go. Omid Scobie is Bazaar.com's royal editor at large and has covered the lives and philanthropic work of the younger members of the British royal family over the last 8 years, as well as spearheading exclusive coverage of major royal milestones, including the weddings of both the Cambridges and the Sussexes. He's traveled extensively with Harry, Meghan, William, and Kate on their engagements in the UK and around the world. He is also the co-host of the AirPod, and he is the co-author of Finding Freedom, Harry and Meghan, and the Making of a Modern Royal Family. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I feel like you ticked all the boxes.
I love that book, by the way. That's a great beach read, might I say.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, it came out at a time where I felt like a lot of us needed an escape. Even if we weren't on vacation or on beaches at the time. But we just updated the paperback. So we're kind of getting ready to go back into the world of finding freedom again.
Well, so you really have had more access than anybody, I think, to Harry and to Meghan. So I was really interested to ask you about two big interviews that they've done this year. What went into the decision, as far as you know, to do the Oprah interview? Because, I mean, it has become such a global story at this point. And then also Harry's decision to do The Me You Cannot See.
Absolutely. I mean, you talk about access. I would say Oprah definitely has that area cornered to herself. It's been an incredible year for them. You know, I think this was the year that we saw the couple really find, or the ability to speak up about experiences and events that have affected them, influenced the decisions they've made. And I think that really we've probably learned more about Harry and Meghan in the past 12 months than we have since they first got together. And I would say that interview with Oprah was really what started it all, because, you know, I think you know as well as I do, they were very keen to get their words out there finally, but there were many reasons why they couldn't. You know, they had a big case with the Mail on Sunday, the newspaper over here in the UK, regarding the handwritten letter that Meghan had written to her father. And so in a way, the couple, despite living these very sort of free and independent lives, found themselves silenced through the sort of legal case that they had with a couple of the tabloids over here. So as soon as they were out of the way, they were finally free to actually talk.
It seems like the Brits have a really hard time understanding how the couple can ask for privacy, but then do an interview with Oprah. Knowing them, spending so much time with them as a royal correspondent and then writing this book, what do you think their answer would be if someone were to ask them that? How do you balance the pursuit of privacy while also doing an interview of this magnitude?
You know, this conversation's always baffled me somewhat. So my background's entertainment news before I sort of stepped fully into royals. And, you know, we often used to do, I was a European bureau chief at Us Weekly magazine. We often used to do things cooperatively with celebrities. So say we did a photo shoot with Jennifer Lopez, or we did an at home with Mariah Carey. That's a one-off moment. That access is consented. It is part of an agreement. There's no way you can just suddenly return to that home the next day to take more pictures without permission. And I would say that's kind of how it is with Harry and Meghan. There are certain aspects of their lives that they do want to share with the world. I think they understand and appreciate that they're public figures. They certainly use the platform that comes with that to its fullest advantage. And so along the way, they bring the world in, they bring us in for those intimate moments, the baby announcements, the sort of family milestones. But I think they have every right to also shut the door when it's not something that they want to share, or whether that moment has already passed. And I think that's what certainly the British media over here really has struggled to understand, because of course they can sit down and talk about their lives with Oprah, but that doesn't mean that you can then go and steal a letter that Meghan's written to her father, for example, and print it in the pages of a newspaper. And that was essentially the argument that was taking place in court during that trial.
And then some have suggested that they are, lots have suggested that they are using the Sussex name or the royal name to still monetize. So what would their reaction be to that? A question like that? How can you ask for privacy, but then pursue opportunities with using their royal titles?
Listen, look, I can stand outside of this and understand why people certainly want to raise these questions. But I think people also, certainly the critics, also need to be willing to listen to the answers. You know, I think for Harry and Meghan, they wanted to make their royal roles work. And ultimately, for all the reasons that they've already shared, that didn't work out. And so in order to then take the next route, they've got to earn their own money. To earn their own money, they actually have to sign contracts with people and carry out work just like you and I do. There's money sort of being used as a transaction there. But I wouldn't call that cashing in on their names per se. I would say it's, you know, we work our way up to a certain status in our life, and that status enables us a better job in the workplace, a more senior role, for example. So of course they're able now to command these large sums, these big deals, because of the platform that they've built. But I would say, listen, at the end of the day, Harry is a member of the royal family. He was born a royal. He will always be Prince Harry. Even if people want to bring up the argument of stripping the couple of their Sussex titles, it doesn't stop them from being members of the royal family, or Harry from being a prince and sixth in line to the throne. And we certainly don't raise these questions for other members of the royal family. You know, we look at, say, Princess Anne's children, Zara Tyndall and her husband Mike, okay, members of the royal family, in line, Zara's in line to the throne, of course. They may not have titles, but they do have the sort of royal branding, that package that comes with anything that they do. So you almost can't escape it. And I think that as long as no one is sort of flagrantly abusing the name or using the name of the crown alongside their work, then I think that we perhaps need to give that subject a rest.
So the decision to open so much in the Me You Cannot See, it is extraordinary to hear. It's really compelling to hear his story about how he was triggered and continues to be triggered by the sound of the horse hooves on the ground at his mother's funeral. How difficult is it for Harry to come forward with these stories, given the family that he was born into? I mean, this is really going way outside what anybody in the royal family has ever done. What is your understanding of how the royal family has taken this interview?
I mean, certainly for a family whose mantra is never complain, never explain, you know, that stiff upper lip must be rigid at all times, Harry has certainly bucked that trend or that lifestyle in favor for one that allows him to speak his own truth more freely. And ultimately, we've seen how much that truth has allowed him to set forth on this incredible journey of discovering better, more positive mental health and that sort of journey of well-being that he's on. We see how much it has had an influence on others, particularly in the male space, where I think the stigma around conversations around mental health is still very much present. Harry, just like his brother William, as they both pledged when they launched Heads Together alongside Kate some years ago, the mental health initiative as part of their charitable foundation, is doing everything that he can to sort of break that down. So I think that to some extent, there is a royal family that understand exactly what it is that Harry's doing. They see that as part of his advocacy and the work that he's been doing in the space. That said, one can't deny that there will have no doubt been very uncomfortable moments for not just royal family members, but aides at the palace when they watched some of the things that Harry shared in the Me You Can't See. Because, of course, he speaks very openly about how that lifestyle, that royal way of living, can actually have a detrimental impact on one's mental health, you know, bottling things up, accepting sort of toxic behavior or outside influences as things that can't be changed, which he quotes his father as saying at one time, you know, it was this way for me, it'll be that way for you. I think Harry's really challenging a lot of that. And I'm sure that that's very uncomfortable for those that only know that way of living.
Do you think that this family can come together at some point? Do you think that the brothers and their father will make peace with the interviews that he's done and the way that he's decided to move to the United States and have his family in the States? Do you think that there's a possibility for them to work things out?
It's a really good question, and you know, one that I don't think I could give you a definitive answer for, because quite frankly, you know, as an outsider looking in and speaking to those connected to this at the very least, it seems like there is no definite path here. I think accountability is something that would be a really important factor in things moving forward. And from what I've seen, there hasn't been much of it. You know, we've heard Harry and Meghan talk about some of the really unpleasant experiences that shapes their time as working members of the royal family, as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. But we haven't heard much from the royal side in terms of owning some of those things that have happened, because everyone has played a role in one way or another. Obviously, the Queen's statement acknowledged the couple's journey and their story, but then it was also caveated with that recollections may vary line. So it sort of has left us in the same place that we were some months ago. As Harry shares more and more, we see the fences are still very much up at the palace. You know, the upper lip is still very stiff. And I don't know if we'll ever be at a point where everyone is off that same approach that Harry's taking at the moment. I think the distance doesn't help as well, because I'm sure if they were around each other more, there would be more opportunity for conversations. People were expecting so much out of the funeral service, or that week of events, remembering Prince Philip's life recently. But of course, everyone was very much focused on that. So it was not the time to be dealing with anything else. So I guess time will tell, that if that's a sort of boringly safe answer.
No, that's okay. Well,
but I think also we've got July, where, of course, Harry and William are still expected to be honouring the life of their mum with the statue unveiling at Kensington Palace. That's, in less than a month now. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly opportunities ahead. It's whether everyone involved grabs them by the horns and takes this on head on.
So my last question is, I got the sense, I wondered watching Harry talk about his mental health journey, whether or not Harry and Meghan felt like they had that royal wedding out of duty. Is that the wedding that they would have chosen to have?
Yeah, you know, I would say, listen, if it was me, I certainly would have preferred something a slightly more low-key. And I think we heard from the couple themselves in the Oprah interview that, you know, they had that moment with the Archbishop a few days before the wedding service itself, just to sort of exchange vows or sort of have an intimate moment before their official sort of legal wedding. And I think that was Harry and Meghan's way of saying that they actually would have liked something perhaps a little more intimate. But I think Harry, you know, as we've heard from both of them, as they've set up this Archwell Foundation, they're both very committed to this life of service and duty. And as working members of the royal family, serving the public and bringing the public in to those very important moments is part of that service as a funded working member of the royal family. So they did what they was required of them. Would it have been different if they had already stepped away from their royal roles or their royal path at that point? Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it would have been a much more quiet affair elsewhere. But I think that that's also an incredibly important and powerful moment in the history of the British royal family that I would imagine that neither of them regret, because it had such a huge impact on the world stage in terms of a mixed race woman marrying into the House of Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
That will always be in the history books. And I think that it's impossible to wish that it didn't happen that way.
Absolutely. Well, the book's called Finding Freedom, Harry and Meghan and the Making of a Modern Royal Family. I loved it. And tell everybody where they can find you.
A good question. If you look for me on Twitter, I am at Scobie, S-C-O-B-I-E. And you can find all my links there, actually, for everything else. But come and say hi.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Always good to be back.
So what did you think about Pink, the performer, going into this documentary?
Well, I've loved Pink forever. I've felt that she's somehow the most underrated performer of like the last 20 plus years. And so I had no idea this documentary even existed, and Carlene put it on and I was stoked watching it. I thought it was awesome.
And then how much did you know about her husband?
I know who he is. I've known he's like a big motocross guy and, you know, was kind of a storied, legendary guy in that sport. But I don't think that any of his accolades is ever compared to what she's pulled off. So, you know, that plus sort of the well-documented history of their relationship, I knew who the guy was and what they were all about.
Okay, so let's talk about her athleticism. She watched a Cher concert as a child and was mesmerized by the acrobats that served as backup dancers behind Cher. And she wondered later in life if she could do the same, but as she sang. And she said that she actually sings better upside down. Talk to me about what you thought about her athleticism.
So it's kind of funny. So remember like the Lady Marmalade video years ago where they were all in their, you know, sort of lingerie type outfits
yeah.
and everything. And so they're all out there looking like super feminine and skinny and everything. And then Pink's out there rocking it, but yeah. she's not the same body type. Like Pink's built, like she's a muscular chick. She looks good, but she's built. And so that always kind of stuck with me. Like, here's this woman that's clearly not the same kind of like wavy diva. She's actually put together and looks athletic. Little did I know that would translate to her being able to do that kind of stuff on stage. But it's kind of incredible what she's able to do up there. And, you know, whether or not she can actually sing better upside down versus right side up, I don't know. The fact that she can sing it all upside down blows me away.
Can you imagine just going across Wembley Stadium like that, that far up in the air, and to be performing in front of people? Like, what in the world?
No, it's flat out insane. And for the people that haven't either seen Pink perform, which I haven't, and I would like to, or aren't aware of what she does in a concert from an acrobatic standpoint, they're going to be blown away by this. It is unreal. I don't think there's another performer, you know, who's known as a vocalist, you know, whatever you call that. If you're up on stage and you're singing, you're sort of the front person of a band or a solo artist, to then go and do this acrobatic thing where you are literally hurtling yourself across hundreds and hundreds of yards all over the stadium midair. It's unreal.
Indeed. So what do you think about the way that she runs this whole operation? I think she said she has over 225 employees. She's clearly a perfectionist. I saw you say on Instagram stories that she would probably make a great president. Do you stand by that?
I do. I think that this is somebody who has complete like ownership and mastery of what she does. And I'm sure there's a lot of really talented people behind the scenes that help pull this whole thing off, but I think it's her creation. And I think she's the one that's putting together every piece of the execution. And so to see that, you know, when she's got all these other things that she's managing as well. You know, you forget the fact she's the one probably writing all the lyrics, you know, coming up with all the music behind it, and, you know, putting together all the choreography, but then to put together the actual production of this, it's pretty incredible. And that takes someone who's absolutely got every aspect of this under control. It was really impressive.
So she's taking her kids on tour throughout the documentary. And she says that she has a life that melds life and work together. So I'm imagining what it's like for us to even go to like Palm Springs. Can you imagine she's doing all of this with her kids on tour? Do you think you could pull something like that off?
No, I don't. But it's a very different thing for her. Like, this is her life. Her life is that. Versus ours, where we disrupt our life to go do something like that.
Right.
And it's stressful and miserable. This is actually her life, and there's clearly enjoyment behind it. I think she has, you know, genuine love for all the people that are in her production. I was saying to Carlene, like, how awesome would it be to be part of her core crew and to get to go and do this and experience this with her? But for her, this is life. It's not like we're on vacation or we're on tour now, and so we disrupt our life for this. No, that's it. And so she's taken the mindset of, how are we going to enjoy this and thrive as a family while we're doing this? I mean, her kids are engaged in every aspect of it, which is amazing. Those kids have no idea how lucky they are to be on tour and to do all this stuff. And I'm sure they're getting, you know, all of the schooling that they need and the tutoring and the education and all that stuff. I don't think that they're lacking any way in that, but they get to also experience like this massive world where most people would never have the opportunity to see that. And she's present with them throughout the entire thing, which is pretty incredible.
So I wanted to ask you about a quote that she said. She said, "I know it's a lot easier for men," and by men, she means male performers, "just primarily to walk out the door and not look back. It just is. There's no way a mother can walk away from her babies and not think about them every single second of every single day and not worry to the point where you can't sleep. And the result is that rock stars who are women, they stop touring because you can't imagine being able to do both." What did you think about that, hearing that?
I completely agree. And I was trying to think of somebody who compares to Pink, a female rock star. And I'm not talking about a pop performer. I'm talking about a true, like, rock star. And I don't think there's anybody that compares to her over the last 50 years. I mean, name someone that is not just like a produced pop performer, but a true rock star. And she's it. I think she's the most underrated performer, you know, singer, rock star of the last 50 years. There's no parallel.
Yeah. Now, I also like to see, by the end of it, I was eager for her to talk about her marriage, because you get to see all these sweet memories with her kids and how she operates her staff of crew, etc. But I really was interested in the dynamics of her marriage. And I wondered, since he had this big career of his own in motocross, do you think that that's the reason that he's willing to come along on these world tours? In other words, do you think it would have been harder for someone who may not have had that level of success on their own to be part of this and not feel emasculated to some degree?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that, you know, to a large extent that, I don't know what went into their previous breakup that happened where she produced that amazing song, but clearly something took place. They got back together. But I think that he has clearly accepted and gotten comfortable with his place in life. You know, he did everything. He was a rock star on his own right in the motocross world. That guy was, you know, king of the hill. But there's nothing more for him to prove. And I think he's very much at peace with supporting her and being dad and managing his family in the way that he can. And he understands very well that him being that version of him is the best thing that can possibly happen for their family.
Yeah.
And it allows her to go out there and just be awesome. And I think he's fully supporting of her being awesome, he already did all this stuff. And so now he gets to just sit back, enjoy life with his kids and her, and watch her go out there and kick ass every night, which is a pretty cool thing.
The one thing that I wish she had talked about was the pressures of competition in terms of other artists, like, and worrying about differentiating herself by doing acrobatics. Like, what if she gets to the point where she can't do that? Even though her voice is one of the best in the business, she has this extra part of her show. And if she can't physically do that, would that fear of competition, you know, someone beating her in the space, come on? Did you think that that was important, the story, or you're like, I got enough and this is everything I needed?
Yeah, I hope she doesn't feel that, because that was something that I wasn't even aware that she did. And I'm looking at, you know, 20 plus years of songs from her that were awesome and her being at the top of her game. And then I learned through this documentary that these acrobatics were part of her production. I had no idea that even took place. So I think her songs and her ability to perform and the quality of her voice stands on its own, that it doesn't even need that. The fact that it has that separates her clearly from anybody else in the business.
Yeah.
Like that's a huge differentiator. And you know, I don't think anyone has a desire to see a 60-year-old up there spinning around. So I don't think she's going to need to rely on that going forward. I just think it's funny that, you know, you look back and think about how, like, at any point in any decade, whether it was this decade, the previous, where there was probably someone else who was considered sort of the pop queen and it wasn't Pink. But all the while, Pink was out there just producing amazing songs and doing these awesome live shows and being this true rock star when everyone else was sort of like the pop diva du jour who faded away.
What is your favorite Pink anthem?
I still love, like, kind of her breakup anthem, the, you know, So What, I'm Still a Rock Star song, like, where I'm going to get in a fight. So I think it's awesome. And I think it's awesome because, you know, there's the Stevie Nicks song where she sings, like, right in Lindsey Buckingham's face about, like, how he cheated on her and broke her heart and everything. And, like, that's a very awkward thing to see perform, where he just has to stand up there and take the beating from her every time. And I think this anthem's a little kinder. It's like she's just basically calling her husband a tool for the way he behaved. I don't even know why they broke up and got back together, but she's calling him kind of a tool, but almost in like an endearing way. Like, you're just an idiot and I'm still awesome and I'm going to go do my thing. And, you know, I'm going to go rage right now because I'm pissed off and I'm going to, you know, figure this out on my own without you. But it didn't create this sort of divide where it couldn't heal again. Like, it was just like, I'm good. You're a tool. And then they figured it out. And that song still completely stands on its own. And they're back together and happy. And they have a very healthy relationship. Their kids are great and everything. But it's still an awesome song that everyone can celebrate. So to me, that's a great one. It's like, here's a way that you can have this sort of breakup song and you didn't completely destroy the ability to reconnect with that person. You created your own freedom. You created your own, you know, path to get healthy again. And by and large, here we are back, like, you know, however many years later, you can perform it in Wembley Stadium in front of however many hundreds of thousands of people. I don't know how many people are there. And, you know, he can be on the side there celebrating it with your daughters. I think that was pretty cool.
So cool. Is it a surprise to you that she's from Philadelphia?
No, it doesn't surprise me because there's a toughness to her that I think is, I didn't know that. You just taught me something. But there's a toughness to Pink that I'm not at all surprised that comes from Philadelphia. She's just a flat out rock star. So it makes sense. There's one other person that I think is a kindred soul to Pink, and that's you.
Do we think that we could perform a duet of a Pink song, make it into a duet for an upcoming karaoke performance? Because we did sing Islands in the Stream together at my last Baby Sprinkle karaoke party adjacent.
Yeah, I think there's a good one she did with, God, what was it? Like Nate Fuse or whatever his name is.
Oh, yeah. That was a great one. Yep.
We could do that one for sure.
Okay.
I think it would be actually a very touching moment for the crowd.
It could be. And then I think as a backup, we could do Raise Your Glass. But then we take the glass and then just throw them at people in the audience.
Yeah, I think basically what you and I do is we grab the mics and we never let them go. And it will start as a karaoke party for everyone, and we'll let them get a couple songs in, and then we're just going to take over for the next probably 12 songs.
Perfect. That's a dream. Well, listen, thank you so much. And thank you for telling me about how great this documentary was.
You're welcome. Yeah, I was surprised. I've always liked Pink. I always thought she was great. And this was like a cool insight to see. So for anyone that hasn't seen this and has any interest at all in Pink, I think you'll be pretty impressed by what she puts together.
Thank you so much.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my great guests, Omid and Steve, and remind you to go to iTunes or wherever it is that you are listening to this podcast. Make sure that you click subscribe so you're going to get new episodes in your feed, and to leave a 5-star review. Jump in the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. It's a blast, and you're going to find out what we're talking about all week. And again, that's Reality Life with Kate Casey on Facebook. My Twitter is at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram, please check it out. Come follow me. I'm at Kate Casey CA because you can see what I'm watching all week. And I do put up my list of must-watch shows each week, so you got to check that out. You can find me on TikTok at It's Kate Casey, on Clubhouse at Kate Casey. I host rooms all week long. And I've got a Patreon page with bonus episodes. So go to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. True crime, Vanity Fair style interviews, Housewives, Bachelor, all those things that you love. I've got bonus episodes. I'm hoping that you have a great week, and I look forward to catching up with you on Friday.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.